another and the natural world.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loright. Well, a week ago, the U.S. assassinated the top military leader in Iran as he was traveling in Iraq. The latest justification by President Trump was that he, Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian general, had been planning to blow up the U.S. embassy in Baghdad. Trump and his aides have drawn sharp criticism from Democratic lawmakers and some Republicans for refusing to disclose what they've been claiming was the imminent threat that Soleimani posed at the time that he was killed in the car that he was riding in at the airport in the Iraqi capital last week. Trump, speaking at the White House yesterday, said, quote, "We did it because they were looking to blow up our embassy. We also did it for other reasons that were very obvious. Somebody died. One of our military people died. People were badly wounded just a week before." Skeptical members of Congress have been asking for some sort of proof to justify the assassination. Another justification for killing Soleimani has been that he has killed either hundreds or thousands of Americans. The official reason for killing Soleimani have changed in the past 7 days, and we posted a CNN timeline list of the differing reasons on our website. You can see it at WMNF.org. Well, according to our next guest, the claim that Soleimani and the Iranian government are somehow responsible for the deaths of hundreds of Americans in Iraq, which has been repeated by Republicans, some Democrats, and the mainstream media, appears to be groundless. Our guest today is Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and the coordinator of the Middle Eastern Studies Department at the University of San Francisco, and he joins us on the phone. Stephen, welcome to WMNF. Nice to have you here.
Great to be with you.
So tell me, why do you say that the allegation that Soleimani killed hundreds or thousands of Americans is groundless?
Basically because, as with these other charges, the Trump administration has refused to put forward any evidence. I mean, Soleimani definitely was a ruthless figure. He's responsible for thousands of deaths in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere. He really is a pretty nasty character, but I get that he, or for that matter, the Iranian government is responsible for large numbers of American casualties, appears to be groundless. It first came out in 2007 when the Bush administration in February of that year started claiming that increased sophistication by these roadside bombs attacking American military convoys were of Iranian origin. They never forward any real proof of this. They said they were too sophisticated for the Iraqis to develop, which seemed odd because just a few years earlier, of course, the Bush administration was saying that the Iraqis were capable of building an atomic bomb and sophisticated missiles. Roadside explosive devices are relatively simple compared to that. And what it appears to be is that the Trump administration has taken these claims from 12 years ago and basically repackaged them without any additional evidence. And so it's been, and while I'm pleased that the media and some Democratic politicians have been more skeptical about Trump's claims about blowing up the embassy and some of these more outrageous charges than they were about Bush's outrageous charges about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, it is pretty rather disappointing. There hasn't been a more critical eye to these essential charges about the deaths of American service people.
So I think the main allegation, if we could tie it, is that during the fighting in Iraq, especially around 2007, that militias that were supported by Soleimani and Iran were attacking American soldiers, and that resulted in deaths of American soldiers in Iraq. Wouldn't that be fair to say, or is that not fair to say?
Well, at least 90% of U.S. casualties were from Baathist groups, hardline Salafist groups, and other Sunni elements. Including various tribal groups that were anti-Iranian, that were did not have any connections with or support. In fact, they were fighting a number of the Shia militias. Earlier in the war, there were the Sadrists, the Ahmadi army, a sectarian Shia group was fighting American soldiers, but they were not linked to Iran. In fact, they have also had conflicts with some of the pro-Iranian militia. The Iranian identified militia, you know, such as those that Soleimani had supported, were primarily involved in fighting these Sunni groups during the horrific civil war, if you want to call it that, the sectarian conflict in 2006-2008. They were engaged in pretty horrific war crimes, atrocities against Sunni communities and the like. But it was as were the Sunni groups against Shias. But the United States was never the main target, and indeed, the United States and these pro-Iranian groups have often been on the same side, fighting the Salafists and the Ba'athists, and more recently, of course, in the battle against ISIS, where these pro-Iranian militia were among the best fighters. I mean, they're pretty ruthless. They also committed atrocities in their assaults and the like. But again, they were fighting with the United States, not against it.
Yeah, that's what I always thought, because I thought that when Saddam Hussein was thrown out of power after the U.S. invasion, that the U.S. was largely fighting dead-enders who were sympathetic to Saddam Hussein. And they, for a shorthand way to say it, they largely were Sunni. And the Shia were pretty happy that we had gone in to overthrow Saddam Hussein, because it then opened the door for the Shia majority to exert power in Iraq.
Very much so, indeed. The Iraqi government has been dominated by sectarian Shia parties. They are, and they had the irony of both the United States and Iran supporting the same government. The United States saw them as the best way to fight the Ba'athists and the more hardcore Salafist extremists, Al Qaeda in Iraq, and some of the literally dozens of armed opposition groups that rose up against the United States and the U.S. / Iranian backed government. But it was interesting that the largest party in the Iranian parliament in the early years was Skiri, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which was a who spent their exile years in Iran, was recognized as the government in exile by the Iranian government, and their armed group, the Badr Corps, which later formed the core of the Iraqi army after the U.S. abolished the original army, actually was literally created and armed and trained by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. In fact, they fought with Iran on Iran's side in the Iran-Iraq War. And indeed, one of the things that led to the sectarian conflict was not about these age-old animosities, as some people called it. It wasn't a theological battle as such, but that the Sunnis saw the Shia-led government as basically traitors for siding with their historic enemies, Iran and the Western powers like the United States and Britain.
Our guest is Stephen Zunis, a professor of politics and the coordinator of the Middle Eastern Studies Department at the University of San Francisco. He's traveling right now. He's in Africa. And Stephen just wrote an article for the Progressive magazine that says that there is zero evidence that Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian general, killed hundreds of Americans. And we're going to post a link to that on our website. So is there a deliberate effort to confuse the American public about who this guy Soleimani is?
Well, I mean, he really, as I say, he really is a pretty nasty character. I mean, there are Syrians and Iraqis and others who have suffered as a result of atrocities by militias that he has supported, who are cheering his demise. So that the nature of the guy kind of character he was is not inaccurate at all. The question is that I think in an effort to for the Trump administration, the Americans to support this policy, saying, well, you know, we can't just say he's a bad guy killing innocent civilians, because there are a lot of people in the Middle East who do that, including some of our closest allies. Let's make Americans think that he's also responsible for killing Americans, and that in that way we maybe can get support about for our policy. And I know this is a rather cynical view, but really I see no other explanation given the failure of the Trump administration, despite frequent requests, to come up with any evidence to back these kinds of charges.
So now that Soleimani is dead, what does that do to the fight against Daesh or ISIS? What does that do to Sunni militant groups in that part of the world? Are they empowered? Are they cheering Soleimani's death?
Oh, certainly. He was their most effective. He and his people were their most effective fighting force against them. And the Iraqi army is so corrupt and inept in a lot of ways. That's why the United States trusted Soleimani's folks to do a good bulk of the fighting on the ground, often with U.S. air support. But on the short term, it's a big boost for ISIS, Daesh, because of the threat of a widening conflict between the United States and these pro-Iranian militias, a number of countries that have been supporting the training and other operations against ISIS have pulled out or redeployed in safer areas. And so we have, you know, less people on the forefront battling ISIS. I think in the longer term, it won't necessarily hurt them, because there are plenty of other people who are fighting them, and Soleimani's replacement, and will continue doing the job, and these militias will keep going. I think in terms of the broader implications, though, is that it united Iranians in opposition to the United States, just at a time when dissent in Iran is reaching an all-time high. I mean, people are really disgusted with our government there. I was in Iran actually back in March and was struck by how widespread the antipathy is towards the Iranian leadership. But I also picked up then, and it certainly has been shown now, that when it comes to an attack on their country or threats to the United States, people will tend to rally around the flag. But perhaps more importantly, in Iraq, there we've also seen months of protests and demonstrations against the corrupt government, which again has close ties to Iran and these Shia sectarian parties. Indeed, Soleimani has been accused of getting his people to shooting in the crowd of these pro-democracy, anti-corruption protesters. With this attack, which many Iraqis, even those who oppose the government, even those who oppose Iran, the assassination as an assault on Iraq's sovereignty, given it happened on Iraqi soil when Soleimani was coming to meet with the Iraqi prime minister to try to find ways to defuse the crisis. Again, you have the rallying around the flag effect, and it strengthened the sectarian pro-Iranian element within that country. The big split in Iraq nowadays is less that between Sunni and Shia as between nationalists and sectarians within both communities. And I'm afraid that the Trump actions have only strengthened the sectarian.
So the current prime minister of Iraq has asked the U.S. military to leave. He wants him out. I'm wondering, is the U.S. staying because it is somehow profiting from the oil in Iraq?
The presence of U.S. forces isn't directly related to oil, but the United States certainly, the initial decision to bring troops back was to fight ISIS, but while there's certainly ISIS still operating, they no longer control much in the way of actual territory as they did for a time. So that rationale seems to be largely gone. It appears, frankly, that Trump wants to keep forces there to try to counter Iranian influence. But the the Iraqis don't want to be a proxy, and they don't want to be they don't want to be the site of a proxy war between United States and Iran. Most Iraqis would like American and Iranian forces out. They would like to be in charge of their own country. Thank you very much. And I think this and Trump's insistence in keeping U.S. troops, I think, is going to cause not just nationalist backlash, but again, it could strengthen the pro-Iranian elements because, you know, just as the U.S. wants to be there to be a counter to the Iranians want to be there to counter the United States. And this whole episode, we got to remember this whole crisis, which came very, very close to a war, and we're certainly not out of a full-scale war, and we're certainly not out of the woods yet. Let's remember it's a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. But had you invaded Iraq, there wouldn't be pro-Iranian militia in that country. Remember, Saddam Hussein was fanatically anti-Iranian. There wouldn't be U.S. bases that were vulnerable to the attacks from these kinds of groups. And so, you know, everything has been going on this crisis the past couple of weeks, including apparently the tragic downing of that Ukrainian airliner, is yet another a tragic consequence of the U.S. invasion to a U.S. Decision to invade Iraq.
Stephen Zunis is our guest. He's a professor at the University of San Francisco, and he's the coordinator of the Middle Eastern Studies Department there. He's written a new piece for the Progressive magazine saying there is zero evidence that Qassem Soleimani killed hundreds of Americans. Of course, Soleimani was assassinated by the U.S. a week ago. The president said in his speech 2 days ago that Iran is a terrorist nation and the number one terrorist nation in the world. The president rarely talks or criticizes Saudi Arabia. How is Iran the number one terrorist nation in the world?
Well, I mean, if you look at the criticisms of Iran, their support for extremist groups, including groups I think that reasonably call terrorists, their lack of free elections, their suppression of dissent, their discrimination against women and religious minorities, their interference in the internal affairs of other Middle Eastern countries. I mean, all of these criticisms are valid. But you could say the same thing and more for the Saudis. In fact, I would argue on every single one of those things, Saudi Arabia is even worse. I mean, the Salafist groups that the Saudis have supported, you know, are at least as extreme as those backed by Iran, and indeed, you know, have engaged in acts of terrorism and the like. And so, I mean, it kind of reminds you during the Cold War where the, you know, we had President Reagan and other people going on and on about how oppressive these communist and other leftist governments are, which again, and sometimes exaggerated, was mostly true. But then we would support these right-wing dictatorships and death squads, you know, which were even worse. And so this double standard really ends up hurting our credibility, both, you know, because, you know, again, countries like Iran deserve criticism. They deserve to be challenged. You know, their behavior is inexcusable, but we are hardly in a position to take leadership in challenging them when we are supporting actors like Saudi Arabia and other autocratic governments in that part of the world. And as a result, it makes us a less effective actor in terms of promoting peace and stability and human rights.
So a few minutes ago, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was at the White House, and he was holding a press conference, and he said they're putting more, the U.S. is putting tougher sanctions on Iran. But he said that he expects the dissidents in Iran to rise up and be more vocal, be more active. And I'm wondering, in the wake of the assassination of Soleimani, would you expect the dissidents in Iran to rise up? You know, given the fact that you were there a few months ago, what's your take on how Soleimani's assassination affects the kind of grassroots democracy movement in Iran?
It hurts it, no question about it. I mean, the Iranians are among the most nationalistic and patriotic people in the world. I mean, they as much as they may hate their government, they have a lot of pride. And for the United States to treat Iran like some kind of banana republic, you know, where we feel we have a right to assassinate, their leaders and bullying them into accepting one-side agreements and to break off international agreements and the like, it makes it difficult for for people to mobilize. And if you look at the history of the dissident movement in Iran, as I have over the years, there's been times when there has been détente, when there's been hope for things moving forward. This is when they grow. This is when they start having an impact. This is when you can more moderate elements in the within the government can start gaining ascendancy against the hardliners. But when Iran is threatened, when they feel like they're being unfairly singled out. I think about back in Vietnam, a big mistake in Vietnam is we saw it as communism, and the way you stop communism is spreading international totalitarian movement through military force. What we didn't realize is that while the Vietnamese opposition were indeed Marxist-Leninist, they were first and foremost a nationalist movement. So we wondered why it was that the more bombs we dropped, the more troops we sent, the greater the opposition. We're making the same mistake in Iran. We see the Islamist character of the government, which of course is true, but their power in large part comes from their ability to manipulate these strong nationalist sentiments. So again, the more we threaten, the more we pressure, the more we assassinate and this kind of thing, it only strengthens the nationalist elements that the clerics have been so good at manipulating to their advantage.
So one more question. Last night there was a mystery. Both activists, human rights activists, and Iraqi officials say some mysterious planes, unidentified planes, hit targets in Syria near the border with Iraq, killing 8 Iraqi militiamen amid the tension between the U.S. and Iran. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the planes targeted positions belonging to pro-Iranian militias in the Bukamal area near the border with Iraq. We don't know whose planes those were that did the attack, but we're wondering whether or not there's going to be a wider war. How would you expect Iran to retaliate for the Soleimani killing?
Well, they already did what they seem to say is their retaliation in the missile attacks on the U.S. bases.
Could you say that they pulled back, that they didn't deliberately target Americans?
Exactly. And that's the thing. They attacked enough to save face, saying that we retaliated, but not so much that it would then prompt Trump to. Then retaliate against that, and of course you'd have this escalation, which could very easily lead to a full-scale war. I mean, we really came very, very close to the precipice, and I was actually somewhat surprised that the Iranian response was so calculated as to send a signal or whatever, but not to give an excuse for a even greater tragedy to unfold. So. But the thing is that this, if you think about all the things that have been happening in terms of Iranian actions or actions by pro-Iranian groups, whether it be in the Persian Gulf or Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Syria or whatever, none of these were going on between the signing of the nuclear accord and Trump pulling out. These have all taken place after Trump pulled out of the nuclear agreement and reimposed sanctions that were supposed to have been lifted.
But wait a minute, the Trump administration is saying Iran upped its terrorism when it signed the nuclear agreement with
not at all. The pattern is just the opposite. That all these events we're talking about happened after the U.S. Withdrew. I mean, certainly they continue to support their allied groups. I mean, they're doing that before, during, and after. So they didn't stop as a result of the nuclear agreement. They weren't required to stop. Just as we could keep supporting some of our people, including the Saudis, who, if you want to talk about civilian death toll, I mean, they're responsible but more civilian deaths than Iran and all the Iranian-backed groups combined. I mean, you look what the Saudis are doing in Yemen, but you know, that was not about the nuclear agreement. And certainly the conflict, the real crises that we have seen, the escalation, is again a direct result of the U.S. pulling out of this nuclear agreement.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much. I know this is quite a long-distance phone call you're making. Thank you for spending the time with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or point out regarding the current tension between the U.S. and Iran?
Well, let me just mention this. I am in Sudan, a country where they are under an extreme right-wing Islamist military dictatorship, which has supported terrorist groups and engaged in genocidal campaigns in Darfur and and we're talking about one of the nastiest, most repressive regimes in the world. And last year, the people of Sudan rose up in a non-violent, massive civil resistance campaign, which overthrew that government and established a democratic, civilian-led government. And this is what I'm here for. I'm researching that. It was really an amazing story. Very few Americans have heard of it. And I think heard about it. And I think what's significant here is that's how you promote democracy. That's how you promote regime change. You let the people of the country do it themselves. Because if we try to intervene, we try to bomb, it just does the opposite. And one of the great ironies of this whole thing is that while the United States taxpayers spending $1.5 billion propping up the Sisi dictatorship of Egypt, we're spending billions of dollars of arms unconditionally to Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, et cetera, the Trump administration still maintains sanctions on Sudan, even after the democratic forces won. And the Sudanese I talked to saying, what is this about? What America really wants democracy? Why aren't they helping us and instead helping these dictatorships, either directly through support of arms or whatever, or paradoxically indirectly, by engaging in actions which just strengthen governments like Iran.
Well, Stephen, we look forward to seeing your article about Sudan. Thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Stephen. We'll talk again. Stephen Zunis is a professor of politics and the coordinator of the Middle East Studies Department at the University of San Francisco. His latest work is in the Progressive magazine, where he's written an article saying that there is zero evidence that Qassem Soleimani, the Iranian general, killed hundreds of Americans. Soleimani was killed by the U.S. a week ago. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. We're going to open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. You can call in and comment about anything you've heard here so far. You can also send an email into the studio. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. I'll mention a few other stories that we might talk about. MacDill Air Force Base here in Tampa, which coordinates U.S. military activity in places like Iraq. MacDill Air Force Base was temporarily placed on lockdown this morning while authorities investigated unfounded reports of an armed person nearby. People on the base received an alert regarding the lockdown at 7 a.m. this morning. MacDill officials said later the lockdown has been lifted. According to police, a 54-year-old man had reportedly armed himself with a gun and went to the apartment of his ex-girlfriend and her new boyfriend on Gandy Boulevard in Tampa and vandalized their door and vehicle. Police say they got word he may be near the base. But the man was found in Hernando County. The man is now in custody at the Hernando County Sheriff's Office. And I'm reading this from the WFLA TV news website. That's one story we can talk about. Also, the driver of that pickup truck who hit and killed a jogger on Bayshore Boulevard in Tampa yesterday has been charged with DUI manslaughter and vehicular homicide. Tampa police say 31-year-old Benjamin Ahas' blood alcohol concentration was 0.234, nearly three times the legal limit, when he drove off the roadway and onto the sidewalk, flinging the jogger over the balustrade and into the waters of Tampa Bay. The driver was arrested. He was driving a pinch-a-penny truck. Bystanders had jumped into the water to try to rescue the jogger. The victim was pulled from the water and taken to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. There is a chronic problem of motorists speeding on Tampa's Bayshore Boulevard. And if you've got ideas about how to stop the speeding on Bayshore Boulevard, call us up, 813-239-9663. Of course, the pedestrian deaths are happening all over the Tampa Bay area. And this story, federal prosecutors say jailhouse video no longer exists of the area around Jeffrey Epstein's jail cell on the day he survived an apparent suicide attempt. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan told a judge yesterday that jail officials preserved video of the wrong jail cell and that a backup system also failed to capture footage because of technical issues. An Epstein attorney says the missing video deepens the mystery surrounding his suicide weeks later. So if you want to call in, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. Let's go to Gary in Dunedin. Gary, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hey, man, thank you for taking me. Let's put all this in context about the assassination of Soleimani, et cetera. So the United States illegally invades Iraq and wreaks havoc there. Just by the definition of terrorism and terrorists, given to justify Soleimani's assassination, then the rest of the world could look at Petraeus and George W. Bush and Rummy and Rumsfeld and Cheney and many of our generals and call them terrorists and designate our armed forces and other groups as terrorist organizations and start assassinating them too on our soil. And that would be fitting in with the justification that Trump and Pence have given and Pompeo have given. It's all just showing you the arrogance of the American empire and why they hate us is that when we do terrible things to civilians, invading and occupying and torturing and all that, we're always righteous according to Trump and Pompeo. But when they fight back against us, they're terrorists. That's the American way, and it's disgusting. We've got to reverse that. We have to stop believing that we are always right and that the people fighting against the empire are always terrorists. It's insane.
And, Gary, why do you think, I mean, we've had people call for the last 6 days or 5 days here on WMNF, who says that the U.S. always operates honorably and that we don't commit that kind of terrorism that you're talking about. We've had people call up and say, our generals are okay, but their generals are terrorists.
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe it's a trait of human nature to identify with your team and to justify and deny. There's sociopaths and psychopaths who don't believe that they're doing anything wrong. There are serial killers who believe they're innocent or that they were justified in doing the horrific crime. I mean, some people just don't have a moral compass and they've been brainwashed. Remember, from the time we're born, and especially in popular media now, which has turned kind of right wing, even if it's supposed to be left wing, America can do no wrong. We're the greatest country on earth. We're a light for the rest of the world. We're spreading freedom and democracy. If you start admitting that we're bad, just like other countries and people are bad, it hurts your pride, it hurts your ego, it hurts your self-image. A lot of people just can't be that honest with themselves, can they, Rob?
Yeah. All right. Gary, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Now, Simon writes in, and he disagrees. He says we should not be listening to what my guest Stephen Zunis says. And this is what Simon says. He says, Stephen Zunis is quoted as saying, while there are certainly governments in the world responsible for far more civilian deaths or other transgressions, Israel stands almost alone in violating this bedrock international legal principle. So then Simon goes on to say, because Zunis said that, one cannot take Zunis's comments seriously. Now, that's Simon's belief. So Simon doesn't like, and I'm not sure where this quote came from, but I'm going to believe that Zunis may have said this. Israel stands alone, almost alone, in violating this bedrock international legal principle of preventing civilian deaths. So do you think, let me ask you this, I mean, is Israel a country that respects civilian life? What do you think? 813-239-9663. Let's go to David in Tampa. David, you're on. What would you like to say?
Oh, hi, Rob. Hey, I wanted to address the Bayshore Boulevard incident.
Okay.
And one thing, I've never understood why there's not more, you know, traffic signals along Bayshore Boulevard, signalized crosswalks, but also, you know, access for cars to turn, you know, left or right, And, you know, if you want to avoid red lights, there's a freeway, you know, expressway. The Stellman is right parallel to Bayshore. So I just think we're long overdue for some additional traffic signals on Bayshore.
And they've added the yellow signal crosswalk signs. A lot of people have said, well, yellow when it flashes doesn't indicate you should stop. It indicates you should slow down. So people have told me they slow down. They're supposed to stop. But how about this, David? Why not make the Crosstown Expressway free from Gandy Boulevard to downtown Tampa to encourage people to travel on the Crosstown?
I think that's a great idea. No, I really think that would. I think that would help get more cars off of Bayshore. I would definitely encourage that. But I just feel like that, you know, more needs to be done to slow down traffic because people ignore the 35 mile per hour speed limit. And they'll tailgate you and speed through there.
I agree with you. I see that every day. I've been spending a lot of time just off Bayshore Boulevard recently, and people are speeding. It's dangerous to walk your dog, as I do, because people are going. They're not going 35, as you said. They're going 60.
So, it's dangerous.
Yeah. All right,
I thought,
Dave.
It was interesting too that guy was working for Pinch a Penny, and I guess drinking on the job. So that's probably not good. Pinch a Penny needs to monitor their employees better.
Yeah, they really do. All right, David, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Great to hear from you. Let's go to John in Palmetto. This is Ken in Tampa first. Ken, you're on first, and then we'll go to John. Hi, Ken, you're on M&F. Ken?
Hello?
Ken, the whole world is waiting for you. What would you like to say?
Yay, the whole world's waiting for me. Well, I'd just like to say, you know, 2020 has started out like any other year. You have people who, when you spout the stuff that president spouts, this is the type of thing that happens. And for him to have all the power to grant after 9/11 is absurd. It shouldn't take back. Why did Obama step forward and take this back? There's a lot of things that could have been done by the Democrats. I'm a independent, but I lean that sure. Never vote for this person in office right now. And when you have this sort of rhetoric going on and this sort of bias towards cultures and everything else, what do you expect? For us to say that our generals, we are a terrorist is someone that terrorizes people. There are like 20, 30 people a month killed by drones that we operate, civilians, that's never reported constantly. So if they came over to America and assassinated one of our generals, so they came up, if they had the power, which we have, which makes us the bully of the world, if they came over to America and wiped out civilians over, how would we feel about that?
Yeah,
I don't think people can step back and look at them.
Yeah, how would we feel about that? That's exactly right. Ken, thanks a lot. We have a little bit of problem with your phone. We're not getting a great connection, but thanks. Thanks for making that point. How would we feel if people operated drones and killed one of our wedding parties? I don't know about Ken's statistics, 20 to 30 civilians killed every month, but I know that we have killed civilians. There are videos of us killing civilians, apparently gleefully. We are not clean when it comes to that, there's plenty of proof out there. Let's go to we'll go to John in Palmetto. John, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. That wedding thing got popular after one of our drones did take out 40 people at one of the wedding parties. So that's often referenced. I have mentioned before about the Iranian airliner that was shot down by the Navy.
The USS Vincennes shot down an Iranian passenger plane. Yeah.
That's right. And after that, we went into Panama in '89, and we killed over 20,000 people in Panama. The World Health Organization claimed that we killed. It was just 2 years after we went into Iraq that we had over 100,000 casualties. So when they get up there and start talking about this one's a murderer and that was. If you're anywhere in the Middle East, you're looking at America as being that, just that, only at a grandiose scale.
You know? Didn't we bomb low income neighborhoods when we invaded Panama?
We did, and we let loose a lot of you know, the Black Hawk, or, I mean, the Black Water group, where there's videos out there showing them just mowing down cars down the highway. It looked like a traffic jam, you know, somewhere, and they're just shooting along, and they're, you know, there was a lot overlooked.
Yeah, all right. John, thanks a lot. Thanks for calling.
I do want to just say real quick about the Bayshore. I thought when they replaced all those things on the line, they should have just made Bayshore two lanes, 25 miles an hour, widened it to where it's already had the longest sidewalk in the country for a while, and made that a complete park. But there's too busy piling on populations.
Well,
let's add a few amenities.
Okay, so we've got a special caller here. John, we're going to talk about that topic.
You got it. Thanks,
yeah,
buddy.
Thank you, John. And let's go to another John. This is John Dinkfelder, who's a Tampa City Council person who wants to chat about Bayshore. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good, Rob. I don't know about a special caller, but I thought I could chime in.
All right. So John, you know, I posted on Facebook yesterday that I think that there are not enough police patrols on Bayshore, because every day, I'm on Bayshore every day, and I see cars going 60 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's a perennial problem. I mean, and sadly enough, going back about 12, 13 years ago, we had a tragedy out there where there was a motorcyclist. It was a base related driver, and I don't know if you remember that one.
I do. Yeah, was it a young woman who was killed that day?
The
driver was going to work. Yeah.
Right, hit somebody, and he was, you know, I don't think it was DUI or anything. He was just going too fast and hit a pedestrian. And Mayor Iorio responded. We created the Bayshore Task Force. As a matter of fact, Vicky was on it. And
you're talking about the late Vicky Pollier, who was a neighborhood leader. Yeah.
Right. And anyway, so we got together a group, and we met with the base, and we met ourselves, and we put together some ideas, and with some of which were implemented. You know, didn't used to have any stoplights on Bayshore, so it was, you know, it was uninterrupted, and so now it's and we've got some stoplights. We've reduced the speed. I think it was 40, now it's 30 something, I guess. You know, so we did some things, but I agree with you. I think enforcement, you know, regular enforcement instead of sporadic enforcement would probably be a big help. You know, the other thing, and I don't mean to blame the base, but in terms of volume. And also speed. You know, a lot of people coming to and from the base seem to be speeding on their way back over to Brandon. But, you know, I've always tried to figure out a way to get more of those base commuters up onto the crosstown. And I'm going to continue to try and figure that out.
Could the city council suggest that the crosstown be made free from Gandy Boulevard to downtown Tampa to try to get some of that traffic off Bayshore?
Well, we proposed that to the Expressway Authority. Unfortunately, they come back and they say, well, the bondholders, you know, demand that somebody pay for those riders, and then does that fall back on the city to subsidize it? Or, you know, we've asked the federal government if perhaps they could find it somewhere in their budget, in their military budget, to help subsidize some of you know, and get those people up there. But I, you know what, I worked on it a while back, and I'm going to revisit it now. Unfortunately, it's tragedies that, you know, have to motivate you to, you know, to do these things.
A ferry doesn't hold that many cars, but would a ferry from MacDill directly over to the South County, would that help ease the traffic on Bayshore?
I definitely think, well, I don't think it's going to be holding cars, but I think it's going to be a passenger ferry. I think they'll leave their car. It'll be park and ride, and they'll leave their cars over there on the other side by, you know, by Ruskin. And I think that's still in the works. I think the MPO has been talking about that, and I know I think our friend Ed Taranchik has been working on that, hand in hand with working on the other ferry.
And the previous caller, John, and I know even some of your constituents have mentioned on Facebook, why not narrow the lane, so cut Bayshore down to one lane in each direction, for instance, and truly make it a linear park. Is that too radical, do you think?
I don't know if it's radical. It's you know, the only problem is, at least right now, until we have better mass transit, you're going to squeeze that traffic out of there, and it's going to go somewhere else. And so then the question is, where is it going to go, especially the base traffic? You know, where is it going to go? You know, if it goes over to MacDill, which is another likely candidate, then you've got another two-lane, you know, small two-lane road that's overburdened.
Boy, so you know, a train from the South County or Brandon to MacDill Air Force Base might be a good route for light rail.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, you know, I think you could probably run something down down at a minimum down Dale Mabry or something,
or use the CSX lines, the parallel to the Crosstown Expressway,
right, to at least get you close.
Yeah. You know, I was reading the statistics. I think there are 15,000 people employed at MacDill Air Force Base. That's a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's and the way this president's going, that those numbers are only going to go up.
All right.
If we keep CENTCOM as busy as he wants to.
All right. Well, John Dingfelder, thanks a lot for coming on MNF.
Keep up the good work.
All right, great to hear from you. And let's take some more phone calls from folks. Ben in Tampa has been holding the longest. Ben, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. When I heard about the retaliation that the Iranians did, I'm going, this is pretty tame. This is supposed to be a guy, the equivalent of Patton, their number two guy. And then I started thinking about Sergei Kirov. You ever heard of him?
No, I don't remember him.
Sergei Kirov was a real popular guy in Stalinist Russia. And they went and had a plenum where they all got together and rubber-stamped Stalin's taking over after the death of Lenin. Then what he asked was, this is anonymous, but who would you guys have picked for number two? It was this guy, Sergei Kirov. And he went and had him assassinated, along with a lot of the people that thought he would have been cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
all right.
I'm like going,
All right. Well, Ben, thanks a lot. Thanks for making that point. Stalin made some really...
finished. The guys over the mullahs, this is the most biggest threat to them. This guy that got killed.
Well, are you saying that the U.S. collaborated with the mullahs to kill Soleimani?
I'm just saying that the only one that would have been a threat to him and the only one that could have taken a military coup was the guy that got killed.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting point. Thanks a lot, Ben. Thank you. Good to hear from you. Let's go to Chuck in Tampa. Chuck, thanks for calling. You're on MNF. What would you like to say?
How you doing, Rob?
I'm good. What's up?
I was observing the Trump rally last night, and I thought Trump did a great job with de-escalating things as far as Iran. I mean, these people, it sounded like an AC/DC concert. These people are going nuts. And I heard, I think 2 days ago on NPR, medium income's up $5,000 a household, and his poll numbers since the impeachment, I think he's 46 or 47%. They've actually been going up. How do you think the fake phony impeachment's going for the
I'm like Ronald Reagan. I'm trust but verify. I'm going to have to verify those numbers. I know that real income has not gone up because inflation has eaten up most of the.
Medium income has gone up $5,000 a household.
Well, I will look it up. I promise. I don't believe that because inflation has gone up 1 or 2% per year, and real wages have gone up only 1 or 2.5% a year. So inflation has eaten up most of that wage gain. But I think our listeners can look it up too to see whether or not real household income has gone up under President Trump. I think that's an important number to look at. But I don't believe Chuck's numbers. I don't think those are right. Let's go to John in South Tampa. Hey, John, you're on MNF. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. You sure do have patience. I'll tell you. Anyway. I live on Bayshore and I ride my bike every day and I see what you see. And I've always thought it should be 25 miles an hour. Let's have the courage to say, look, this is a great little road. Stop and smell the roses. Look how the rich people live. It's a beautiful sight. The Bay Vista, it's gorgeous. Lower it to 25 because we all know 25 means 35, 35 means 45, 45 means 55, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just, the city has to have the courage to know that this is, their people say, the crown jewel, right? And I agree, but it's got to get lower to 25, and the hell with the commuters. I'm sorry. And thank you, Rob.
All right, John, thank you. Thank you. Good to hear from you. We're getting some emails, a bunch of emails. Here's an email from Imad, who says, much of Bayshore traffic is commuters avoiding the toll and the crosstown. Free between Gandy and downtown would eliminate the traffic problem, writes Imad. All right, Imad, thank you for that. Michael writes this, let's put a trolley too in the space. Okay. Michael, I hope I read that right. And then also Terry writes, war is terrorism. It's the terrorism of a large, rich country. Terrorism is the war of a small, poor country. So if we can attack a sovereign country and kill a leader, why can't they? Lead by example. P.S. Why can we have nuclear weapons and other countries cannot, writes Terry. And then Kevin writes this, Native Americans who were fighting terrorism since 1492 would disagree with the assumption that America is always the good guy. Look at our history, writes Kevin. Let's go back to the phones, and you are listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Let's break the gender line late in the show with Fran in Largo. Hey, Fran, you're on.
Oh, thank you, Rob. Yeah, it's interesting that that Chuck guy just called about being at that Trump rally. My question is, are these rallies really just like a following around thing, like, say, the Parrot Heads with Jimmy Buffett, or, you know, that kind of a thing, the Deadheads with the Grateful Dead? Is this like a cult, the same people going to them? Are they adding any new people? Because they always look the same to me, these folks. I'm sure they put different ones in front of Trump, but basically they look about the same to me with the hats on and the red, white, and blue costumes and all that stuff. I just would like to know. I don't have access to a smartphone or computer or anything. Maybe I could find out on that, but seems to me, you know, he did his predictable rally speech after the zombie-like speech that he gave to the nation about this whole invasion thing, or this assassination thing. If you could just answer that, is it basically the same bunch that shows up?
You know, I have no proof, but I for my friends who are use facial recognition, I think we should try this. I think we should do facial recognition software
idea.
On all the people who sit behind President Trump at his rallies, because I swear some of the same people show up rally after rally, like the guy who has the group African Americans for Trump. I swear he's in like every other rally, but I don't know how he gets the preferred position, but he's always there. He's the guy from South Florida who's goes to every Trump rally, it seems.
And there's another woman with long blonde hair.
There are a bunch of blondes who look very similar to Trump rallies. Now, I have not done the facial recognition, so I don't know this to be a fact, but I would love to see a college project where you use facial recognition on the people that sit behind the president and see if there are people who recur rally after rally. Fran, thanks. It's an interesting thing. I think somebody should do it. I don't have time, but I would love, if I was retired, I would do that in a heartbeat. Let's go to Matt, who's calling from Avon Park. Matt, you're on MNF. Thank you for calling. Hi, Matt.
Well, thank you for your show. I think it is doing a good job of getting a lot of different views out there. One of the things I wanted to call about, well, first off, about Bayshore, I go over there sometimes on business, and I think what one of your callers said earlier about eliminating the tolls on the Crosstown Expressway, I think that would do a lot to alleviate the traffic problem there. Because almost all of that, like you said, is commuter traffic, and those people are flying through that neighborhood.
Yeah, that's really true. Yeah, there is a lot of commuting going on. Hey, Matt, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but thank you. Did we lose you?
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to hear from you. Thank you for your compliment. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us at 813-238-8001 and record your comment about this program on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back Monday at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for the next show. We're going to hear the Tom Hartman radio program because, unfortunately, Janelle is under the weather today. Thanks to Patty Perkey and Frank Knox for being our phone producers today. I'm Rob Lori. You're listening to 88.5 FM. This is WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Stay tuned for the Tom Hartman show right after the news, and then Art in Your Ear comes up today at 1 o'clock. Let's go up to Washington, D.C. and get the latest news from NPR.